Sea levels are rising fast, and superstorms like Sandy and Katrina are predicted to become yearly occurrences. And yet, Congress has resisted dealing with even the most basic facts of climate science. So it's fallen to local governments to take steps in preparation for future storms. Kate Shepard describes the federal government's struggle to keep up with an increasing number of storms and why relief agencies like FEMA and the National Flood Insurance Agency are billions of dollars in debt in an article in the July-August issue of Mother Jones called Underwater, Flood, Build, Repeat, Why We Pretend the Next Storm Won't Happen and Flush Billions in Disaster Relief Down the Drain. I'm very pleased that it brings Kate Shepard to our show. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Do we know how many people in total suffered from property damage after Hurricane Sandy?
You know, I don't know if I have a final number of people. I mean, we do have an estimate of how much it was going to cost, and it's about $60 billion, and that's spread over, you know, all up and down the eastern parts of the East Coast that were affected. But we know it's, you know, hundreds of thousands of homeowners were affected in some way, whether that's minor flooding or complete loss of a house.
Now, that $60 billion, that's also projected into the future, because aren't people still repairing damage from the storm?
Right. Well, I mean, that's the cost as of what we know right now. That's the cost that was allocated in the disaster spending bill passed by Congress. But, you know, as you said, there's still people who are still fixing their houses. There's areas that they haven't really even figured out how to deal with it yet, but you know, it's an ongoing price tag.
You open your article with a description of the destruction of New York's newly refurbished South Ferry subway station by Hurricane Sandy. How much money did the city spend in 2009, 3 years before Sandy, to renovate the station?
Well, they spent $545 million in 2009 to renovate the station, which I think was probably the, if not the most, but among the most expensive refurbishments we've seen in the city. And now it's going to cost them just about that much to redo it after the storm, which I thought was really a sort of shocking figure, right? And here we are in New York, the most, you know, efficient, advanced subway system that you can imagine, and we've built this brand of beautiful new station, but we didn't even foresee an event like Sandy, and we didn't plan for it at all.
The city wasn't aware that there would be storms of Sandy's size hitting New York in the near future?
Well, for years we've seen projections of storms that could be of Sandy's size. I mean, obviously Sandy was a very special event because we don't typically see Atlantic hurricanes up that high or approaching in that direction at that point in the season, and because it was just so large, and because of the particular way the storm surge happened, it was bigger than most people might have planned for. But it was within the realm of projections that we'd seen for a big storm in New York. It should have been something that had at least in mind when we were thinking about how to build along the south end of Manhattan there.
Was it part of the conjecture when Maya Bloomberg formed the New York City panel on climate change as part of Plan New York NYC in August 2008? The city's long-term sustainability plan.
Right. So Bloomberg was, I think, being forward-looking and putting together that panel, and the panels, even their very earliest reports, looked at the prospects for flooding and storm surge in lower Manhattan, and so they had a pretty good idea that something like this might happen. But as you said, that was, you know, 2008 when they put that together, I think. So they put the first report out in 2009, so, you know, every level of government reacts very slowly to projections like that, and so they hadn't really started changing or accounting for those things that they're projected as they started rolling out new engineering plans in the southern end of Manhattan. I think that'll be different going forward. I think we've now seen exactly what could happen when we see a storm like this, and I think that they'll start reflecting that in plans going forward.
Well, I don't even remember that plan. It probably didn't get all that much attention in the press.
Probably not. You know, I feel like I'm somebody who covers climate change, so I see a lot of these kind of reports coming out. But, you know, how much attention they get in the local level, and how much, not just attention, but I mean, how much funding goes to the sort of, okay, action steps that come out of those plans is always, you know, the big question.
Well, how aware were the people who live in the areas that were most likely to be affected made? Did anybody tell them if there is a major storm, you're going to be in serious trouble if you remain here in Dumbo or along the East River or the Hudson River?
Well, you know, property owners who are in a 100-year floodplain will know that they're in a 100-year floodplain because they have to acquire flood insurance. So if you are a homeowner in that area, chances are you probably had to acquire flood insurance at some point in time. The real question to me is, going forward, how many more homes are going to be in the floodplain than are right now? And that's what we're seeing with the new maps that FEMA's been rolling out, and they show that a lot more people are going to be in that area in which would be expected to be affected by a significant flood. And with climate change and sea level rise going into the future, we're going to see a lot more of that. There's a new report that FEMA put out just last month that showed that we're probably going to double the number of homes that live in the 100-year floodplain by the end of the century. So a lot of people who right now aren't will be in the floodplain. So there will be a lot more awareness, I think, going forward, as people realize that they have to buy flood insurance, that they're being told that their homes are possibly going to be affected by a major storm. I mean, I think that things are changing pretty quickly in those areas.
Okay, flood insurance. What about the federal government's role? How much will the government bear the cost of repairing damages from these natural disasters?
Well, there's some two levels. People who are insured by the National Flood Insurance Program, it's a federal program, so the government, in theory, people should be paying enough premiums that keeps the program stable, right? But when you have a really significant storm like a Sandy or like a Hurricane Katrina or Rita, those really have broken the bank on the National Flood Insurance Program. So they've made it so that the government had to basically bail out the flood insurance program several times, and now it's more than $20 billion in debt because of those big storms. And so it's making it so that the program is no longer solvent. So that's one area that the federal government plays. Another area is just on disaster spending overall. After a big storm like this, we're spending $60 billion on Sandy recovery. That's, coming from disaster relief, emergency spending from Congress to go to these states and municipalities that are affected by the storm. And that's funding that, we don't plan for in a particular budget process. Every time a disaster happens, basically Congress has to go back and find that money and approve it to donate it, to contribute to those areas going forward.
And we're seeing more and more resistance to that kind of funding in Congress, at least if there aren't budget cuts made in some other areas to offset that.
Right, exactly. The more disasters we have, the more we're coming back to the table and asking Congress to approve more disaster spending. I mean, the hard part is, it's not the period of time after disaster is not the time to start shortchanging areas that obviously need the funding. What we need to be doing, and what I sort of the point I make in this piece, is that we need to start thinking smartly long term about how to spend that money and sort of investing that money on the front end in mitigation and management strategies that are thoughtful about what will be different in the future, and not only spending it after a disaster happens.
Earl Blumenauer, a congressman from Oregon, is one of the loudest critics of the federal government's disaster policy, and you met with him the day after the $60 billion Sandy relief package passed the House, nearly 3 months after the storm. What was included in the package, and what were his objections to the package?
Well, the package included, obviously a lot of money that was going to states to be used to address their local needs, but also a lot of funding going to Army Corps of Engineers for different coastal projects. The biggest criticism from people in Congress who have advocated for smarter spending, like Congressman Blumenauer, is that we're not conditioning a lot of that recovery money on coming up with a really smart, forward-looking strategy. A lot of times the money is just given to states and localities, and they are basically able to use it to just rebuild exactly as it was before the disaster. There's not a whole lot of thought given to, what will this be like in 20 years in this location? When will a storm like this happen again? How do we plan for changes from sea level rise or climate change? More changing of storms due to climate change. How do we plan for that when we start rebuilding right away, rather than just doing the same thing over again and expecting a different result? And so I think a lot of people who watch or who are seeing what's happening on the coasts wanted to see the disaster conditioned on a lot of those things and a lot of more forward-looking thinking about how to spend that money.
Well, how much of a role does politics play in all of this? Chris Christie, a recent report indicated, actually change the makeup of the commission that looked into these kinds of things and had a lot of the predictions of disaster taken out of the final report. He replaced the scientists with business people and real estate people, and the reason given is that they have a more realistic view of what goes on in the real world than academics in some ivory tower situation. Then Sandy hit, and he became a hero when he worked with President Obama.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, you're absolutely right. This is what we've seen in, you know, repeatedly, is that instead of listening to scientists about sea level rise projections or storm projections on coasts, we basically only focus on the business and real estate community and pretend like there's not going to be something different in the future and ignore that. I mean, it's not just New Jersey. Last year, North Carolina lawmakers basically made it illegal for the state scientists to include future projections of sea level rise when their climate projections into their future projections of sea level rise. They had to only look at the historical record. They couldn't take into account any other information. That was because of a lot of pressure from the development and real estate, you know, world, because coasts are the most expensive property. They are also a very large source of tax revenue. You know, they're very desirable places to live. I mean, who doesn't want to have a beach house? I mean, there are a lot of political reasons that we ignore these sort of scientific reality on the coasts and instead just sort of focus on the how do we make this a good place for business to continue developing going forward.
Kate Shepard's article, Underwater, Flood, Build, Repeat, Why We Pretend the Next Storm Won't Happen and Flush Billions in Disaster Relief Down the Drain, is in the current issue of Mother Jones magazine. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Kate Shepard, whose article, Underwater, Flood, Build, Repeat, Why We Pretend the Next Storm Won't Happen and Flush Billions in Disaster Relief Down the Drain, is in the current, the July-August issue of Mother Jones magazine. You focus in your article on Gloucester County, Virginia. Why choose that area of the country to cover in depth?
I chose Gloucester for a few different reasons. One, because I think that the planners there have been very forward-looking in trying to address repeated loss on the coast, and by going out and seeking out grant money from FEMA, by hiring a grant coordinator to make sure it was easy for people in the town to get those grants, and really just by, I think, acknowledging that the coastal reality was changing and that they needed, as a community, to do something about it, or they were going to start losing members of their community. So they, I think, were really, really smart about that. Another reason I looked at Gloucester is because Gloucester is, I think, it's really emblematic of, I think, the situation here in the U.S. It's a really old community. People there, the families there have been there basically since the very earliest English settlers here in the U.S. It's close to Williamsburg and Yorktown. I mean, it's a very historic area. It's very beautiful. It's very rural. It's on the coast. You know, you have some communities there that, you know, they have really actually been there for hundreds of years. They still have, you know, sort of really, like, some people in the community there have really specific accents that you don't hear anywhere else in the U.S. I mean, I think it's a very special community for that reason. And also I picked it because it's in Virginia, and Virginia as a state has, you know, pretty much flatly denied climate change. But here you have this community that's seeing it happen right now and trying to deal with it without much help from the state. So I just thought it was a really good place to see what was happening on the ground. And it's also a little bit, you know, I think a lot of times when we think about sea level rise, we hear about Miami or maybe we hear about New Orleans, whereas Virginia is sort of closer to home for me here in Washington, and I think sort of maybe not the place that a lot of people think about when they think about the challenge of sea level rise.
Is Gloucester usually hit hard during hurricane season?
They've been hit hard by a few different storms. Irene hit them pretty hard, and several different nor'easters. Actually, nor'easters for them are a lot more difficult because they're less predictable than a hurricane. When you have a hurricane, at least you sort of have a little bit of warning. The nor'easters just tend to sort of hit them a little bit harder just based on where they're located on the coast. So they've had several different nor'easters in the last few years that have done quite a bit of damage in the community as well.
So they can't go to Virginia's state government and ask for help. They went to FEMA instead. And what kind of relationship did they develop with FEMA?
Well, FEMA has this hazard mitigation grant program for quite some time, and that's been used not just in Virginia but all over the country to help places after they've experienced a flood. And so basically, usually to get this grant money, you have to have had at least one significant loss in a flood, and oftentimes more than one loss. Homeowners can get this grant money to either raise their house or take a buyout. You know, in Gloucester, the majority of people have chosen to take the grants. in order to raise their house. So the house will be put up on stilts or put up on a much higher foundation, you know, 5 to 10 feet off the ground, so that next time there's a big flood, the house is out of the floodwaters. The other option is to take a buyout, in which they're just basically paid a flat amount of money for their home, and they can pick up and move elsewhere. Most people in Gloucester have not chosen that option. Because, you know, a lot of them have a long history there. They have a lot of family there. Who wants to leave? But increasingly, they're seeing more people who are taking that option just because they don't want to deal with the storms and the flooding over and over and over again. I mean, even if your house is raised off the ground, you still have to deal with, you know, what do you do with your cars when it floods? You're stuck in your house. I mean, it's not a very safe place to be, even when your house is off the ground, but it's better than nothing.
Do these are these houses without basements? I've always wondered, when you raise the house, what happens to the basement?
Yeah, I mean, like, the houses that I've seen that were raised, they don't really have a basement anywhere. They might have a place underground where you might park your car, or you might keep things that you aren't really concerned about. But it's not because of the water table being so high there, you don't have a basement like we would have here in Washington.
How much does it cost FEMA to raise a house, and is the whole cost covered by FEMA?
It depends on the size of the house, obviously. I mean, a lot of the houses I saw were somewhere in the range of, you know, $80,000 to raise a house. I mean, some were much more expensive if they were larger, but, you know, I watched a few different ranchers raise that were about $80,000. The homeowner plays a percentage of that. I think it's usually about 5% that they pay, and the rest comes from the Hazard Mitigation Grant Program. And then the local government pays a little part of it, too, but most of it comes from FEMA, which makes it a lot more possible for homeowners to do this program. I mean, most people can't afford that much money to raise a house. So with that grant, it makes it possible.
In your article, you say the only topic touchier than whether the residents of Gloucester should abandon their homes is why the problem even exists. Why do they believe that? What do they believe has caused the massive flooding over the past decade?
Well, this is one of the things I thought was most interesting when I was down there. You know, some homeowners would say that, you know, I think that climate change is making the storms worse. You know, other people would say that I just think it's just a cycle, or, you know, we're just having a bad few years. You know, people had sort of different thoughts about why exactly they were having more flooding. I thought the most interesting was that the local officials didn't really talk about climate change. They just talked about flooding and recurrent flooding and sort of trying to talk to people about that issue and not about sort of the causes of it, because they didn't really want to alienate people. Because I think, you know, in a lot of places, climate change is still an issue that not everybody is really convinced of. And then they basically just didn't want to touch that topic because they didn't want to make it more political than they needed to. They just wanted people to raise their houses or get out of harm's way. So they just declined to talk about climate change in most cases.
Because it becomes a political issue instead of a practical issue.
Right, right. I mean, the practical issue is that your house is flooding. Whether that's climate change just probably doesn't really matter to the homeowner. They just want to know what they need to do.
The article under discussion is Underwater, Flood, Build, Repeat, Why We Pretend the Next Storm Won't Happen and Flush Billions in Disaster Relief Down the Drain. It's written by Kate Shepard and is in the current issue, the July-August issue of Mother Jones magazine. How much of the federal budget is allocated to disaster spending?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, if we look at the front end of the budget and how much money we spend on preparing for disasters or putting it into our disaster fund, it's not much at all. I finally figured out was maybe about $90 million a year go to disaster mitigation. And then there's
$90 million?
$90 million. It's a very small amount that we actually allocate for disaster preparation.
That's raising 10 houses in Gloucester, isn't it?
Well, right. No, that's not including FEMA's budget. FEMA budget is separate, sorry. But no, that's for mitigation programs in particular. FEMA has a much larger budget than that. But then a lot of the spending we do on disasters is on the back end. It's after a disaster happens. And then you do emergency spending bills and say, okay, here's $60 billion, you know, for Sandy relief. It's not something that we account for in our budgeting early in the process. We only do it sort of as a response.
And we had real tensions when there was talk of Sandy relief. Some people who lived in areas that will not be affected by these kinds of storms decided that they weren't going to support it. And then later, of course, their areas saw major destruction from tornadoes, but they saw it as two separate things.
Yeah, I mean, I have to have a degree in psychology, I think, to figure out what's going on there. But you know, it's a lot easier when it's, you know, not your district to say no to the money. When it's your district or people that, you know, you represent are affected by it, obviously there's a much more impetus to approve that money than there is when it's someone else.
How much money does the Obama administration's proposed 2013 budget plan set aside for disaster relief?
I'm trying to make sure I get the number right. I don't want to screw it up. It was lower than it had been in the last previous budget. It was about $1 billion lower. I think it was about $6 billion for the next year.
The National Flood Insurance Program went $16 billion in debt after Hurricane Katrina. How much farther in the hole is the agency now after Sandy?
At our last tally, it was about $21 billion in debt, I believe. But I think that's, like, as we said earlier, you know, we haven't finally figured out exactly how much it is because they're still settling out a lot of payments from Sandy.
When was the National Flood Insurance Program created?
National Flood Insurance Program was created in the early 1970s, addressing a need for it because there really wasn't a private market for flood insurance. And so they created this program so that people who live in disaster-prone areas could have some kind of flood insurance.
Because there already were some disastrous hurricanes.
Well, right.
Maybe not as big as Katrina or Sandy.
Right. There have always been coastal storms. There's also always been coastal flooding. I mean, it's not, it's not the only because of climate change, but it's certainly being made worse by what we're seeing in terms of sea level rise and the changing storms along the coasts.
Has there been any movement in Congress to reform the program?
There have been several attempts to reform the program. Most notably last summer in 2012, there was a pretty significant change made to the flood insurance program. It will increase the rates for a lot of homeowners so that it will bring them up closer to market value. People who have second homes in particular will have to pay much closer to market value. We grandfathered a lot of older homes into the program, so they didn't have to pay market value rates, but we're starting to phase that out. And it also makes it easier for FEMA to offer straight buyouts to people rather than just lifting the house. It allows them to pay the full cost of a home, so that creates a much stronger incentive for people to take the buyouts and move away from hazardous areas. So those reforms last summer were pretty important. They didn't go as far as a lot of people, I think, who are advocates of reform would like it to go. I think they'd like to see the program much more cost-stable going forward than it is right now, but those were pretty significant changes that were made last summer.
FEMA recently changed its floodplain maps, which are used to determine who must buy flood insurance. What areas are now claimed hazardous along the coast that weren't in the previous maps?
Well, the new maps that they've been rolling out for New York and New Jersey did show a significant increase in the number of areas or the areas that are covered under the 100-year floodplain. A lot of people who weren't in it before are now finding themselves in the floodplain, which means that they'll have to acquire flood insurance going forward. But those new maps are really based on past what we've already seen happen. They're not really taking climate change into account when they're looking at going forward.
The proposes projections for sea level rise.
Right. It does not yet include all of those because FEMA was working on a study for a number of years looking at how climate change would affect the National Flood Insurance Program. They just finished and released that study last month. But those figures are not even being taken into account in these new maps. These new maps are just providing basically an update on maps that were in some cases 30 years old. It's not clear when we'll see even newer maps that account for future projections of sea level rise. But this most recent FEMA report found that we can probably expect that the number of houses that are in the floodplain will double by the year 2100 just because of changes in sea level rise and storm surge projections and also changes in population because people keep moving to the coasts regardless of the fact that we're seeing these storms.
Well, so, do you think that the fact that people are going to have to buy flood insurance might discourage some of them from moving into these areas that have not been covered in the past?
I think that's absolutely possible. I mean, insurance is basically a way that we can guide people's decision making, right? I mean, if it's too expensive to acquire insurance, you're probably not going to build a house there. And so it is a way, I think, to guide development in a way that's reflective of the risk. And so I think that's why a lot of people would like to see the program updated to actually really reflect that risk of living in certain places in the U.S.
But do you think it's likely that we're going to have that kind of updating, considering all the political ramifications of that kind of proposal?
Well, you know, it'll be interesting to watch. I mean, they've already seen in Congress a number of efforts to stop the changes that were made to the flood insurance program last summer, to basically stop them from changing the rates on homes. And so there's always pushback because the people who are affected by it obviously don't want to pay higher rates. But, you know, if the program is going to work in the long run, they absolutely have to change something. And so, I mean, there will absolutely be political pushback. We're already seeing it. But I think that if the program's going to work, there's no option but to make it more reflective of the actual risk.
And for a city like New York, where so many things were affected by Hurricane Sandy, can we act quickly enough to change the way we our policies to protect ourselves for the future?
I mean, the question of can we do it fast enough is always, I think, the most important question. I mean, I think there is a lot that can be done to change planning and development strategies. I mean, I think there's a lot that can be done. The question is, are you going to do it fast enough, and are you going to devote enough money to making a decision on the front end rather than waiting till something bad happens and then trying to figure out how to fix it?
Kate, we have a link to your story, Underwater Flood, Build, Repeat, Why We Pretend the Next Storm Won't Happen and Flush Billions in Disaster Relief Down the Drain, on our show page at WNYC.org. Otherwise, you can read it in the July-August issue of Mother Jones. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for having me.